You might say that's already successful, that we've done better than some of the giants. We do more deliveries a day than Amazon have ever done with their drone delivery program. If we did nothing else, we've paved the way for the industry.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is Bobby Healy. He has been on my hit list for years to come on the podcast. He is building Manna. Manna could potentially be the biggest company ever to come out of Ireland. Here's my chat with Bobby.
Over the past 5 years in this podcast, I've spoken to loads of amazing Irish businesses who grew from one idea to become world-class companies, able to compete with the best on the international stage. And many of those started up and grew with the help of their local enterprise office. From starting or growing to become more sustainable or digitization, the local enterprise offices have everything to help make it happen for your business. Visit localenterprise.ie or click the link in the bio below. Okay, you know me. You know I'm massively into my health, fitness, and training. But there's one thing I haven't spoken about before, and that is a product I take every single day. It's a product called Resilience, and it's made by an Irish company called Ethos. What's kind of funny is that every single entrepreneur I meet, that is the one characteristic they have, incredible resilience. So I like that little play on words. It's a multifunctional supplement that supports cognitive function, immunity, which is super important this time of year, energy levels, and it keeps stress at bay. I also love it because it's easy. If you're bringing anything new habit into your life, it has to be easy, and taking Resilience is so simple. I simply mix it in a glass of water every single morning, and I always throw a couple of extra in my gym bag to keep them with me. It's a really tasty blood orange flavor as well. It ticks all the boxes. It has B vitamins, amino acids, vitamin C, and adaptogens like reishi mushroom and ashwagandha. So if you want to try it, I think you should. Go to weareethos.com. And because I like it so much, the guys have given me a discount code. So if you go to weareethos.com, enter Gary Fox at the checkout, you'll get 20% off, which makes taking Resilience about €1 a day, which is an unbelievable price for building some inner resilience. Check out weareethos.com. If you've been listening for a while, you'll know Iconic Offices have been my partner and home in the pod for a long time now. Working and recording in their spaces has helped support the ambitious goals of the pod, and to be honest, really helped it grow. So I partner with them to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, the opportunity to work from Iconic Offices spaces and experience it for yourself. No fees, no catches. Simply visit the Iconic Offices link in the show notes below and enter the code GARY24 and claim your free co-working day pass, or bring the whole team with you and book a day office. Bobby, welcome to the pod.
Pleasure to be here.
You've been on my list for a long time.
Thanks very much. I wish more people would say that in a good way.
Depends on what list, right?
Yeah, true. Yeah, yeah.
Welcome. You are a titan of Irish industry.
Thanks. The only one blocked by Dmitry Medvedev as well, speaking of lists.
You're some man on Twitter. You're prolific.
I am, yeah. Yeah, I actually deleted it the other day because I'm too prolific on it, and then I reinstalled it 10 minutes later. It's great. It's one of those things, compulsive things for people that like to complain and moan and bitch and take pot shots anonymously. But for someone like me, I genuinely get a lot out of it just reading and kind of seeing what people are saying. I find it interesting. But more importantly, it's a super way to market a business or a personal brand. Really, really good. If you have something to say.
You are good on it, though.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that are shy. They put out the same bland, boring PR stuff.
Yeah. Whereas, well, most people are afraid to say things. It's like public speaking, right? Just, you're afraid. Empire has no clothes thing, right? And they think about everything they say, and they think it's smart, and then they type it, and then it's like, oh, fuck, you know, that's... And they prefer not to say it rather than be caught out being looking stupid, whereas I'm the opposite. I'm always caught out looking stupid, and it's fine.
But you can say the most inane, positive thing, and it'll get taken the wrong way anyway.
Well,
so people are going to take it the wrong way anyway.
That's what block is for.
Precisely, right?
And any intelligent audience that you care about acts respectfully, right?
The real people.
The real people
exactly.
Act respectfully. And so long as you avoid, you know, the usual politics, religion, all those things, you're safe, right? If you just talk tech, it's very rare that someone will take a pot shot at you. And I mix the both, and I
was going to say, you do the opposite.
No, you stray into both.
Right?
No, I shouldn't. I should stick to my own domain. But it's too tempting to have a go, you know, Jerry Adams or whatever, for the crack, you know. I enjoy that. And I, you know.
Do you think about it?
Because
I was on Twitter the other day and I was reading one of your tweets, and I was like,
I wonder, does Bobby think about this? Like, does he like sit down and go, right, today?
No.
It's just bang.
Bang. Yeah. Yeah.
But you're on it then to kind of like also meet people, communicate.
Brand. No, it's a tool. It's a business tool, first and foremost. And I would encourage everyone. Like a founder that I know, a US business, they just raised 5 million seed and he's on a, you know, Slack channel that I'm on, a shared one with this particular venture firm. And he's posting his message, hey guys, you know, we raised a round, you know, developed a new product, blah, blah, blah. Would you push up my message out? It's on LinkedIn. Here's the link. Just like it or comment on it, whatever. And I said, yeah, great, done. Because I have a big LinkedIn following and that's really good promotion for him. And I says, send me the Twitter link as well. And he says, we're not really on Twitter. And it's like a huge mistake because, and I say this to, you know, founders very close to me as well that I know in Ireland, and they just don't like the limelight. And it's not your choice. You know, it's like, I don't give a shit if you don't like Twitter, if you don't want the attention, it's your job. You know, it's building presence and it's how you sell. You don't sell directly through a feature list. You sell by people respecting you and treating you like a leader in whatever field it is. And the way you do that is thought leadership. And thought leadership channels are Twitter and LinkedIn. You know, they're not.
It's the biggest challenge I have, I would say, about growing this podcast, because I will have incredible people on and I'll hear the same thing over and over. Jeez, I'd never heard of them.
I've heard of you a lot, but probably because of Twitter.
Yeah.
I would say.
Glad to hear it. But beyond that, say when I have an interesting entrepreneur on who I find really interesting, I know a lot about, then I'll put the episode out and people are like, geez, yeah, I never knew about that person. They're interesting. And then I'll go to retag them. Don't have a Twitter. Don't have an Instagram. Yeah. Don't have anything.
Yeah.
Can't repost anything.
I can call out someone to embarrass them, actually. You know, Mike McGurty, who's my, you know, ran Car Trawler with me for like 15 years. And now we co-founded another travel technology business called Mailey, and he runs it. He's the CEO and I'm the pretty face, you know, but he should be driving that with Twitter. Mm. And instead he has a fabulous marketing team, you know, really good, but just doing typical marketing things, you know, and I'm like, Jesus Christ. You know, there's so many ways to seem and act cooler that actually gets taken seriously and you become the leader in your space. But I would say he's the norm rather than the exception.
Yes, he is.
Few
definitely.
Enough people are, I would say, like me, where they don't really care that much. You know, like, you know that 9 out of 10 people are listening to what you're saying with an open mind and want to hear what you're saying and are listening. And then the 1 in 10 that might, you know, have a go at you or think you're a dick or whatever. I don't care about them. And I think a lot of people are very conservative when it comes to public messaging and it doesn't serve them well, you know.
Look, I wish they're all like you because they're all afraid of what my stakeholders think, what will potential funders think, what my customers think. And it's exactly what you said. Marketing is pretty boring, especially companies are pretty fucking boring.
Yeah.
And it's people. It's people that actually people are interested in. Their stories, their narrative. That's why this podcast is about the people. It's not about like great companies. It's about the people behind them.
Good, honest conversation about interesting things. Everyone wants that all day long. Yeah.
And there's no list of questions. I often get asked, PR teams will say, can you send over a list of questions? I'm like, there isn't any. It's about Bobby's story.
People usually send me a list of questions and I intentionally don't read them when they do. Because it kind of defeats the purpose and it's better to surprise me anyway.
Yeah. And they're overprepared then. They come in and they're they've overthought about everything and they've stressed out about this one stupid question that I mightn't even ask. I'm like, it's your story. Just talk about whatever you want. Is it an Irish thing though? Is that more so here? Because I do see a lot of Irish founders afraid to dip their toe in the water.
No, I think it's common everywhere. Even in the US, I see a lot of founders, even in my space in drone delivery, literally all my peers in drone delivery, none of them have a voice on social in a way that they should do, you know. They do a bit of podcasting, but it's all gloss and polished and to win an inch of its life by the marketing and legal team.
Corporate podcasts are dull.
Yeah.
Dull.
And don't forget, right, we're in the VC world as well, right? So we're VC backed and businesses like ours are also going to be VC, venture capital backed. And venture capital is full of brash, arrogant assholes as well, right? So they want to back brash, arrogant assholes or people with just, we're the best, we're going to bat it out of the park. There's none of this sober, you know, we've got EBITDA or we're none of that. It's ambition, craziness, all that stuff. Yeah. And you're kind of, I won't say whistling to that audience, but there's a certain amount of it is, well, it's not even acting. It's giving your company and you an identity that matches the high risk space that you're in. Like, look at Elon, for example.
You know, I was only thinking about this yesterday.
Yeah. Like, apart from his recent, you know, the craziness, he built his brand on Elon, you know, now doing some very cool things, right? But if IBM had built, you know, rockets that were planning on going to Mars, no one would give a shit. You know,
but even that though, Bobby, like, he didn't say we're building a rocket company. He's like, my goal is to populate Mars.
Colonize Mars.
Jesus, yeah. Unreal
species.
You know, he's not like, oh, I'm going to build this thing to launch satellites. No,
but he's also on Twitter now. Ignore all the right wing stuff and all that stuff. But you know, the Elon from, you know, a few years ago, and the start high growth of Tesla and all that stuff is just a. The openness and the real time streaming nature of what he's saying and interacting really served them well and served the brand well too.
Why do you think he's kind of taken a bit of a twist?
Lots of people do. I mean, like, it's nothing to do with people's intelligence. I think it's kind of there's a lean. The algorithm is partly responsible too. People have beliefs, you know, whether they're deeply convicted beliefs or not, and we don't all agree with each other's beliefs, but we can get our beliefs confirmed, you know, and doubly reconfirmed. And the biases in social have a large role to play in that. And so that's why extreme views are amplified in social, but in Twitter and Facebook, you name it, because it's attention, right? Nobody wants to see the same old center line being taken all the time. They want the fight. It's a blood sport, right? So when people say something, they get endorsed by 100,000 people that like their stuff and are saying good stuff. That's drawing a crowd, and they're going to keep going.
Is he feeding off that? Like, is that what do you think he's kind of gone a little bit more?
I think he's very special. I think a lot of people would. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure. He's in a bubble for sure. And he's in a bubble because, look, you know, he deserves to be in a bubble. Look at the success. But I think no matter how smart you are, you have to be influenced by, you know, whatever's in your bubble. Mm. And you see that in micro ways, even here in Ireland, the right wing movement online. I mean, you meet any of those lads in a pub and have a pint with them, and they're absolutely normal people, like your brother, your sister, or whatever. They're as Irish as be Jesus, you know. But then you see them online and they're issuing rallying calls to burn down buildings and torch anywhere a migrant will go. And
where does that disconnect come from?
I think it's just a bias and in what's presented to them, in largely, you know, groups of people with roughly the similar views. I think that amplifies itself. It's kind of recursive almost. Might call it an echo or an amp chamber, but I think the fact that it's profitable for social channels to continually amplify things and reinforce things, it's just natural. That's the way to get the audience, right? So those audiences find themselves, they grow stronger, and therefore they get a deeper conviction of their own beliefs. And I think it goes deeper and deeper. This is why China don't allow any of that stuff and control it, because they've got 2.5 billion people they have to control, and you can't, in their view, let that loose. And the best democracies in the world do let it loose, and you get all this crazy stuff happening, you know. So, and social just puts that all on steroids. But I'd have the open approach all day long. I totally agree with keeping social channels open and uncontrolled, like Twitter does. But there's a degree of just inappropriate stuff, like the rampant anti-Semitism or anti-Muslim or
is that
whatever,
should that be pushed back on the companies, or how do you, because like this is one of those age-old problems. Like I'm like you, I believe social has far more good than bad to bring, but there probably has to be some sort of.
No, I don't think it should be pushed onto the companies. To be honest with you, if I had the answers, other people would have the answers too. No, nobody has the answer to this. I think it's just going to take time to flush through, but I think authorities have a role to play, regulators have a role to play. Would I take the EU approach? No, because they made a balls of GDPR and cookies and everything, so I wouldn't let them near anything else, right? But at the same time, there's definitely social is playing a role in all the bad things that are happening. And so I think if there's a role for intervention, it needs to be purely around election interference. And that's where I would end
it. Okay, on broader things. Okay, I gotcha.
Yeah, I think so. And I think if you look at Chinese or Russian interference in US outcomes, I think that's probably where I think it's fair to say, okay, government, you're allowed to intervene here. And, and you know, if you want to have democratic values and you want to run a democracy, you have to protect the vote, right? And make sure that the vote is for citizens of whatever country. And politics has its set of rules about fundraising, about access and things like that. And if state actors aren't subject to those rules, fine, I get it. They're doing their jobs too. But I think social has a role to play. And we saw it in the last US election with Facebook and, you know, all those things that went on. I think they're probably warrant getting involved. But outside of that, I would let free rein. And if people want to make fool of themselves with weird, wacky views, fine. So long as it doesn't go to incitement to hatred, yeah, violence, all that stuff. And all that stuff that Twitter had was valid. It's now, it just doesn't exist now. You can say anything you want about people. And
probably went a bit too far the other way. Do you think you are so good on social because you've nothing to prove? Like, you've done it, you've found it, you've exited?
No, I'd be the same. I've always been the way I am. I haven't changed a bit. I have my views. They're not very strong, deeply convicted views. If I had Twitter, you know, 30 years ago, I'd probably be the same. A bit more foolish, but not much more.
How many companies have you founded now?
5. This is my 5th. It's easy to found a company. It takes 5 minutes. Call your accountant. Set up a company. But how many have I run? 5, yeah. Deeply run.
Yeah. What were they? What are they?
Eland, VTI, Cartrawler, Mana, Melia. Was that 6? That's 5. Another one, 6. The Doodlebug, which is video games. I only ran that for a year. That went out of business quickly. It's all people should be doing if they have a skill, as in, like, my trade is I'm a programmer, right? I can program, so it's a trade. And I think that's where you have an advantage over everyone else. If you have that trade, you can build a technology business. So I think if you have a trade and if you love it, if it's genuinely your passion, and that's not just a cliche use of the word, but if you're obsessed with coding or engineering, robotics or video games, whatever it is, then I think you're far better served by building your own thing.
Was that that's how you started?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I'm a programmer, still am, you know, and it's a huge advantage to build in a company to be able to write the code yourself. Like Cartrawler, I wrote most of the code at the start.
Really?
The first 6 months, nearly all my code. Two or three other guys then as well, but a tiny team all writing the code. So that's all free, right? So you can, like, programmers can bootstrap their own business and quickly have a product without a cost and inverted commas anything, right? Mm. So, and then once you have a product, there's zero marginal cost to building to everybody you sell to with software. So, you know, you're better, like, when you think about the balance of value for an entrepreneur, for the domain of starting your own business, being an entrepreneur, tech people have a massive advantage because their initial cost base is far lower because they're just donating their time. So it's not real cash, it's just opportunity cost. And the upside and de-risking that provides is significant. So what I mean by that is you could have a side gig of building your own business, building the product that, and you can bring it the whole way to, does it work? Will it be sticky or not? Without raising any money, without needing anything other than your own time, which is, by the way, very enjoyable building the product. So you can really get a minimum viable product for free if you're a programmer, and you can test whether it's going to stick or not for free. So, and then if it does stick, then it's very easy to demonstrate that you have something that's really valuable because there's no marginal cost to, right, selling software. And so when you think about whether to start a company or not, I'd bias towards starting a company rather than working for, you know, a company. Primarily because I think it's more fun to build your own thing, right? It's better to, it's good to build, right? and that's interesting, and you're learning. So it's just a better time you're having, right? But just on its own, that's probably not enough. You'd need a real job to pay the mortgage, right, and all that, those things. But the upside potential and the risk is just, the upside potential is bigger and the risk is less if you're, you know, an engineer. So bias towards that, if you're an engineer, like anyone in their at the start of their career, by all means, take a job somewhere, but don't get used to it. And you should have the ambition to build your own company.
The golden handcuffs is always the issue, though, because they get hired at massive money.
First thing they do is they get the big car or the house, and that's it. It's all over.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
How do you
yeah.
think about starting and testing and experimenting and getting to that 0 to 1 point?
Tricky, because the different companies I've built have had different profiles, very different. So, you know, Eland was, I already had a deal, you know, done for quite a big contract value to build a piece of software, because I had kind of, I would say, tricked this company into believing I could build it.
So you'd pitched what, an idea to a company? Or how
yeah, there was, there was, it was, it's a long time ago. It's back in, geez, it's 1991. It was like before the universe was built. and there was a bit of deregulation happening in the US, long story short. There was a regulatory opportunity, right? And I was working for a company in the south of France where they had a product for that, but it was a big company. They moved slowly. And I, you know, I was banging my head against the wall trying to move fast to build, you know, something cool. And the big companies just can't do that. They're just too risk averse, and they weren't going to move fast enough. So I said, you know what, I can build a company, do this myself. And I went looking for a customer. I found a co-founder who's an old guy. At the time, he was 50, which, you know, to me, irrelevant in the world. And he really did the work of finding a customer in Mexico for it. But it kind of made it easy to start that business because we had a customer that was going to fund the business essentially,
okay.
right?
So yeah.
that's not a high risk business really, right? But it, as it turns out, it was, because, you know, went really badly wrong because that company went bust, didn't pay the bills, all that stuff. But it wasn't what I would call getting into a 0 to 1 game. It was yeah. very much a marginal cut and paste. And it had a good upside, as it turns out. But that was 12 years of hard work, right?
So the first one was 12 years.
That was the second one. The video game thing was first. And that was 1 year, 18 months. So the second one was 12 years, yeah. And 12 years, six of which were living in different countries and traveling savage amount, absolute sacrifice, massively, genuinely huge sacrifice, but every day of which I enjoyed. But there was no family. I didn't come back to Ireland for a few years. There was constant travel. There was no opportunity to build a personal life, right? And I would say if I had tried to do that, like, my life could have gone a different way. I could have met someone in Mexico where I was living and, you know, fallen in love, got married, have children, and that's where I'd still be.
Yeah.
You just, it's random. It's very, very random, right?
I love when people say that, because people are like, oh no, it was this and this and this and it was
not
all planned
all.
Out.
Oh,
and
no,
it's
no,
never,
no.
like, that's
no,
not life.
Like, life is a meandering river, right? As we all know. And
it's funny though, we all know that, but we think linearly.
But
as
you change your odds, right? You change your odds of, like, if you prefer to do the mad stuff, it's likely you're going to, you know, burn bridges behind you and not be worrying about the long-term future. And I've never thought about the long-term future. I've never looked past the next little while and always done what I think I'd enjoy doing.
Even still?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, just look at Mana, for God's sake.
Oh, we'll get to that. I'm really curious how this started, but we'll get to that.
So I definitely, most of the business, well, I think all the businesses to date have been very easy to build. Very low risk. Like Cartrawler was obvious because Cartrawler leveraged my previous company, Eland, which was selling to airlines, big e-commerce stuff for airlines and travel agencies. And I knew the space already, and Cartrawler was obvious. Like, I knew this was a product I knew that the world wanted, the airline world
you
wanted.
You sold Eland, or how did it work?
Sold Eland, yeah, to CETA, and it was fine, made loads of money, learned about gardening for a little while. I had a 2-year lock-in. And 2 years and a day, I started building Cartrawler. Now, Cartrawler existed. The Turleys had started a car hire company with cars. But it was really that, with a website to sell their cars. But the point is, there was domain, like in any good business, you need domain expertise, right? Someone needs to know the domain. And then you need strong technology and marketing component, right? You know, which is really what people see in a business is the flash and the thought leadership and whatever, right? But a very key enabler for certain businesses, but largely speaking, the easy value to create is when there's a domain expert and you wrap that with technology. And in the case of Gartrawler, it was the Turleys knew they've been running Carhartt for, since 1956 as a family, the gritty, dirty industry.
How did you partner up with them?
I was introduced to them, pure chance. But that goes to my previous point, you know, like Meandering River, right? I was introduced randomly to the lads because a common friend that we had, you know, saw that they had a car thing, that they had potentially good business, but they needed tech, you know.
Right.
Like the typical
I know a
thing,
tech guy.
We just need an app built, you know. But it was very much different than that. In the end, you know, I met them and I looked, they had the domain experience. I had kind of tech and domain because the big opportunity for Gartrawler was always airlines. It was always B2B SaaS. It wasn't car hire for sure because that's a terrible business. And so it was a really good marriage, but it was completely random chance.
Mm-hmm. And what was the plan when you got together?
Well, I would say they looked at me with deep distrust. Why do they need this guy? And I looked at them thinking what you have now, you know, is not what the real value is. I would say that was the sum of the conversation. But they had a great chairman or advisor running the business, Dave Hargett, and he made that marriage work, you know. And then Mike McGarty came in 3 months after me. And so, but it's a good example of it's not really an entrepreneurial business. It never was, you know. It was just, you know, there's an opportunity. Let's just grab that one that, you know, there's a child running by with some candy. Let's just, you know... It was so easy. I know that sounds strange, but it was not a difficult business to grow. And the strategy was clear and simple. And the tech was clear and simple. I built the tech in 6 months and that code is still running. You know, it's like not difficult.
And how long were you at that one?
15 years.
Mm. See?
But that's the thing, right? There is no instant success, right?
Exactly. I mean, if you're building, that's why I love doing these chats with people because, like, it's never overnight success. There's this bullshit around entrepreneurship of like Instagram entrepreneurs and Twitter entrepreneurs.
Oh, you know, I shared a tent with one of the Instagram founders, Mike Krieger, camping in San Francisco, a 2-man tent, yeah. And he's great at guitar. And we had this discussion, you know, and like he'd been battling, he had started 16 businesses before Instagram, you know. Now, that's a little bit.
It's a lot,
you
know, the other way.
A little bit crazy, right? I a little bit different than that in that I'll wait a long time to be certain of the idea. And I was a year thinking about Mana, building notes, learning, studying, talking to people before I said I'd go for it. Mm. But to the point about, you know, 15 years, so 15 years, 12 years, so like these are large investments in my time.
I think that's what people don't get. They're like, a lot of the entrepreneurs I talk to, it's the same story.
Mana will be more, you know. When I was 49 when I started Mana, I said, do I have the energy to, for a decade, I was saying, like, do I have a decade? Because it's not, do I have 3 years? It's, do I have a decade?
Yeah.
Because I'll be 59 by the time we get the exit or whatever, I can step away. And that's like, you know, that's just the way it is. And I learned that not just from my own experience, but that's just the way it is, right? So I said, you know, am I willing to give a decade? And a decade, high likelihood of a zero return for that decade of your life, right?
So this is the question. You right? This is the question I wanted to ask it. You. I've watched you build Mana for the last couple of years and I've watched it and kind of gone, Bobby has been so successful. Why?
Start well, I wouldn't Mana. Be, I would never have been concerned about failure. Spectacular failure. So long as I failed the right way, right? So the idea wasn't stupid. The execution wasn't naive and stupid. Like a lot of businesses fail because they're just dumb ideas or bad teams or whatever. So I know me and my team are a good team. The idea is worth doing. There's no vapor concept there. It's viable, you know? So if we fail, it's going to be for an unknown and unexpected reason, like the physics don't work or you can't get the unit economics to work or the capital economics or the regulatory doesn't work. There was a lot of ways for Mana to fail and still are, right? It's still very, very tough business to make viable. But at the same time, I would have absolutely, other than obviously, you know, the loss of the decade and getting no money out of it, I wouldn't, nor would my team, go away ashamed that if it didn't work. We wouldn't be celebrating it either, but we'd be happy to talk about it and try to figure out why it didn't work and help others in the process. So there isn't a start, stop, did it work, did it. It's not binary, right? We've already succeeded, if you think about it that way, right? We're already, now we do more deliveries a day than Amazon have ever done with their drone delivery program. And they spend $3 billion getting to where they are with very smart people, right? So you might say that it's already successful, that we've done better than some of the giants. We're already operating with profitable unit economics. We already have an aircraft that's delivering into back garden. So you know, if we did nothing else, we've paved the way for the industry and we've set some standards. So
it seems different though than your other businesses, because you explained it really well. There, it's obvious. It's obvious.
Yeah.
Is drone delivery obvious?
It still isn't to a lot of people, but there is, because, you know, I'm fundraising all the time, I was meeting investors, and the big reasons for investors to say no are usually ones that they don't know why. But in our case, there's a million reasons that they can point to say why not, right? And primarily because it's illegal to do what we're doing, and that's not a great start, right? And also there's very big lobbies, or, well, I won't say lobbies, but there's very big existing use of the airspace, which is our precious channel, that is highly highly regulated and hugely safety, you know, critical and very, very conservative, slow moving, right? So i.e. aviation regulators around the world. And so when you if you're an investor and you look at the space, you think, you know, this could be 20 years away.
Yeah.
And so what I liked about MANA, I think, was when I started to study it and when I felt like I understood it sufficiently, what I liked is, first of all, the scale of the problem. That is 5.2 billion food deliveries a year, growing at 15% from the top four players, right? Uber Eats, DoorDash, and a couple others. So it's big industry, and it's big industry with a huge problem, right? So problem of economics, gig economy, labor. It really is a huge addressable market.
It seems to be a money incinerator, though. It seems to be a way of burning money.
It is. A lot of capital has gone up on fire. Yeah. And primarily because, I don't think people fully understood how difficult it is to scale a business that's relying on humans and cars and roads. Like, if you think MANA's hard, it's a lot harder to make money if you're hiring humans and trying to get them to carry a hamburger around, you know. But if you look at the economics or the fundamentals of last mile delivery, they don't work for low value things or for point to point. What I would say is a highly perishable point to point delivery. And so I liked that. I like the fact that at least I felt kind of hunch driven that robots could do it. I hadn't obviously proven that, but it felt like it's not a stretch to imagine you could repurpose a drone.
Where did the idea come from, though? Because like all your other businesses kind of followed that thing of it's an obvious problem and I've domain expertise. This seems like a veer left for you.
The idea came genuinely. I tell the story all the time, but the real truth is I was sitting in my back garden and I'm playing around with drones because, you know, curious mind. And I was just thinking, be very cool to get this to deliver a bag of chips from Libros in Ballantyres down the road from my house. That was the extent of it. And that is the reason I got into this business. I thought it'd be good crack to retrofit a delivery device onto a small DJI drone. And I kind of did fart around with the API and build some autonomous stuff with it. But that was the seed. And then I started to study the tech side of it. Obviously, I did an RFP to a bunch of engineering companies to build a drone for me. So I learned about the tech part of it, the domain, kind of what skill sets are needed. And this is, by the way, a joy for me to learn. Like, I'm learning like hell and meeting really interesting people. And then I'm also studying the business side of it. So food delivery, and there's a lot of data you can get. Mm. You can screen scrape or you can buy reports and stuff. And it was pretty clear it's a big industry with big structural problems with unit economics. So, you know, and then I'm thinking, what great crack it would be to try and do this. And then the final, so it's all a, so it's a seed, and then you qualify certain things, right? Technology, is it viable? Will the economics work? You know, can you, how much can you narrow down and de-risk the go, no go thing, like landing on the moon? And the final bit was I met the aviation regulator, actually the IAA, and Declan Ryan, who's obviously tied with the regulators, introduced me. So I got to have a really good open conversation with the IAA. And that was the final part of the puzzle for me, because they were great and they were as enthusiastic as I was.
Really?
Yeah. And you wouldn't think to hear, you know, aviation regulator and innovation, they don't sound hand in hand. But truth is that the IAA were cheering us on. They were saying, yeah, we, what do you need from us? Let us know. Now, you know, it's obviously illegal now, but there's a lot of stuff going on in Europe and we're at the table and it'd be great to do this in Ireland. So like, that was what I needed. That was the kind of final, I would say, stakeholder or actor that gave me confidence to say, this is doable. You know, it's doable. And not even difficult. It seemed at that stage. And it hasn't been difficult. What I would say is business like Mana is extremely clear on what the steps are and what the components of each of those steps are. Unlike a lot of businesses where you kind of define and evolve your strategy as you're growing and you're talking to customers, and you're kind of, I won't say pivoting, but you're adapting and finally you get to some state where you know what the next steps are. And Cartroller would have been like that. Eland would have been like that. VTI before would have been like that. But Mana, I mean, I wrote some notes. One day I'll publish them, but I wrote some notes that I kind of dissolved or you know, boiled and reduced and stuff over time. And that was my plan. And if you look at those notes now, the detail in them, nothing has changed.
What was the plan?
Well, it was the plan of how to build it, what to build, what order to do it, what things needed to be done, who I needed to hire, and what the strategy would be, go-to-market strategy.
Do you think all this seems obvious to you now because you've done 10 years, 12 years, you've done all these different plans?
If I publish my notes, I'm going to publish the notes soon. I just don't want to, too early. But like, if you look at what's in those notes, it's exactly what we've built. There's been very little things we've needed to change. And that, by the way, is not because I'm a genius in any way. It's just because the particular thing we're building, it's obvious what to do. It's just there's a lot of things to do. Like there's a lot of components and you need a lot of capital, you need a lot of different skills and stuff, but it's very obvious what each of the components are that you need to build and the order you can do them in and the level of parallelization you can have to, you know, go faster.
Is that the programmer brain though? Because I think to a lot of people, they'll be like, drone delivery, where would I even begin?
It's a procedural brain. I think it's like how do you eat an elephant, right? You know, lots of small bites, right? It's the same, right? It's, which parts of the elephant are there? And then break it down, continually break it down such that there's no large pieces that you can't identify, right? And then some of them are in your control, such as the engineering, and some of them you have the skill set for, such as the software, but most of them you don't have the skill set for. Even if they're, I would say, deterministic and clear, you still don't have the skill set. So you need to find the people for it. And then others are not in your control. So think right brain. So regulation, policy, those kind of things. But the plan is very much a technical thing to build. It's breaking down the problem, reverse engineering, and, you know, whatever you don't know, and breaking it down into people, skills, and a project. And if I think most people are capable, like I think most people would be capable of doing it the same way I've done it. And bear in mind, I was a year putting this plan together. So a lot of work, research and different things and meetings.
So you spent a full year just figuring this out?
Yeah. 6 months I probably could have done it in because, you know, I was all doing other stuff as well. Mm. But yeah, I was doing a lot of work and I was meeting engineering companies kind of to see if strategy-wise, I didn't know whether to buy or build our own drone. And that was a big question. And that question I answered before I started the business. And I kind of answered that by, look, what are the skill sets to build a drone? Like, what type of people do you need? I have no hardware experience at all. So that was a learning experience, but a very enjoyable one, right? And that's, I think, when you're building a plan, the more you can the more you can de-risk the business before you go for it. Because I've had loads of ideas, by the way. And a great, a funny one in my life that I find funny is, if you remember Pointy, Mark Cummins of business, right? So I had this great idea well before Pointy, right? And it was so funny. And my idea was, God, there'd be great data set to sell supermarket data, right? You go and figure out how would you get all the price, all the products, and Jesus, what you could build with that data. You could have, you know, localized Amazon or whatever. And I liked that business, not because I could see the business in it, but because of the tech, it'd be good crack. And I had devised a shopping trolley with a scanner on it, and to collect the data, I was just going to push it around and build the tech to do that. And I found that really interesting and good fun. And then I was through the guys in Frontline that invented Pointy. I met Mark Cummins, who had actually built it, but much smarter, right? If you look at what Mark built and his team, of course I went with the brute force approach because I was playing around with computer vision at the time. And therefore, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? So it's computer vision. What Mark did was just a simple little device between the parallel port and the printer in the point of sale, and record what the point of sale was actually doing. Easy, bit of OCR up to the cloud, and you have real-time inventory and pricing, right? Much smarter. And that's a great example where, for Mark and his team that were hardware guys and AI guys, they could have gone software like I was going, or hardware, and they had the breadth of skill set to make the right decision. Whereas if I'd built that, I would have built it with the wrong technology.
You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, but I was at least not dumb enough to go for it. And I had killed that idea before I met Mark.
Okay.
You know? And I can't remember why I'd killed it. I think probably because it just wasn't exciting enough. Or maybe, as I recall, I was still in Car Trawler anyway. I had a day job. But it's a good example, I think, of, look, it's great to have ideas, and it's really good fun to get those ideas and start to learn about them and then qualify them. But it's very important to kill the idea quickly, or be really honest with yourself about whether the idea has a right to survive or not. And don't just take the first idea you find, build, and make that your startup. Wait till you really have something that, as hard as you try, you can't kill it because it stands up to scrutiny.
Is that it? You stress test it until you can't kill it.
And that's why I spent so long before I actually started Mana, because I really did qualify every single bit that I could have qualified before I started to, you know, invest in it and look for investors' money. And
it sounds expensive to start this.
Not really. I mean, probably took, I would say $500,000 or $1 million to prove out the tech part. You know, we built a drone, small team in Wales, you know, of kind of robotics, you know, guys, but hobbyists. So enough to get over the hump of to prove that, you know, could be done. And then, yeah, I mean, it has required that we've raised $43 million so far, and we're 5 years going, and we'll need still a lot more investment to become really a throttling up viable business, right? But that's fine because it's a $1 trillion space, right? And even if we just get 10% of that, it's hell of a prize, right? So $43 million is table stakes for coming into the right casino, right? Mm. It's the same. It's no different. Like if you're playing at the $2 blackjack table, you're coming out with $50, best case, right?
Context is everything.
Yeah, it is. It is. And in our case, if you look at our peers, Amazon has spent $3 billion on their drone delivery program. Google, that have an amazing, really, really good program, have spent somewhere between $1 and $2 billion. Zipline have spent $1 billion, and we're ahead of them all. Actually, well, Google are ahead of us slightly, but you know, we're up there with them. We spent $35 million.
Surely they buy you soon.
We wouldn't sell. Sorry, everyone asked me that, right? Of course we would sell, but
the number would have to be.
It's a thing, right, where you say, right, okay, when is the right time to sell? And you don't sweat it forever, right? You say, okay, look, there's a path, right, where we're creating value and we're adding a zero each time. We're not doubling the number, we're adding a zero each time we get through a growth phase or a progress phase. And our ambition now is to really go for it and build really, really big. And so for us now, I think in a not a bad way, but the word failure, again, it's there's no really no such thing as failure. But for me, if we sold, like we've had offers already, but if we sold, it would be falling short of our ambition. And I've sold my last three businesses and they weren't falling short of their ambition. They were sold at the right time because there was no way to go further and we were better off being part of another organization. But in this case, it's a standalone business and it can remain independent. And we're already signing gargantuan deals. Did I pronounce that wrong? I probably did, but very large deals already, right? So we're now starting in the commercialization phase where we can see the value we're bringing and we're signing nine-figure deals with companies. So we're at the stage now where we can start to moderately collect revenue for the business.
And what are you doing for them? Like when they sign deals with you, what does that mean?
Delivery. So we big brands, we haven't published them, but you'll hear about them soon enough. But very big, well-known brands around the world where we're delivering their products for them and we're replacing the road-based delivery with drone-based delivery. And one of the deals we've signed is worldwide, is Europe and USA. So the reason I talk about that is because that's the boring part of our business. That's the real business part where you're actually collecting revenue and you start to become financially attractive. And that's the easy part of this business. But when you think about creating value, we're only really starting to be priceable now because we're going to start growing revenue, right? So there's so much risk in this business that to price an asset like this is very difficult. And so the way we look at it is we look at the size of the market, 5.1 billion deliveries a year. We can reach half of them because it's suburb. So 2.5 billion deliveries a year, average basket value of 30 quid. It's a lot of money, right? That's got terrible unit economics. It's growing at 15%. So we want a piece of that market. And if we sold our business now to somebody else, they'd get all of the upside of whatever growth comes, obviously. So it wouldn't be right. So long as we can capitalize the business well, so in other words, raise enough money to grow at our natural ability. And what I mean by that is, you know, if we got $1 billion tomorrow, we'd waste it. We wouldn't be able to spend it, right? So the business can grow at a natural rate and you can't go any faster. You can go slower, but you can't go faster than your natural rate. And the natural rate for us, we know what it is. We know how many aircraft, we know how much volume the product is built. So, you know, I think the only way we fail will be no other team will beat us because we have made more progress than anyone else and we're ahead of pretty much everybody else. But the capital environment, because we're in Ireland, particularly because we're in Ireland, but also we're in Europe, which is even worse. Like Ireland's a really entrepreneurial place, very business friendly. Regulatory setup here is fantastic. Great customer here, end customer as well. So like Ireland has ticks a lot of boxes. But with Ireland, where Ireland fails and fails badly is access to capital for businesses like this one, right? So big bet. High ambition businesses are not well served here, sadly. And we're making great strides. I mean, the work going on, like I'd point to ICIF, I'd point to Enterprise Ireland as doing solid work there. And every 10 years, Ireland gets exponentially better. And just look at the accelerator setup that we have here now with Dogpatch and NDRC, all these things. These are substantial improvements in a decade that start to get Ireland into a place where companies like Manna should exist. But right now, a company like Manna should not exist in Ireland.
Do you need to leave Ireland then?
Yes and no, right? So the answer initially is no, because so long as we can raise capital, we're better served by being in Ireland. You know, perfect access to tech talent, wonderful country to be in, pro-business government, pro-business regulator. So we have, it's a Goldilocks country for building tech company, really is. So no, we wouldn't, like, yes, we might get, if we went to San Francisco, there might be more money, or if we went to London or Berlin, there might be more money, or it might be easier to find it, but everything else would be backwards.
Can you raise capital here? Can you raise the money you need here?
No, you couldn't. I mean, there aren't funds that would do large B rounds. Like we've done an A round already. There really aren't funds that would lead a large B round in Ireland.
What kind of numbers are we talking?
Our only peer, Zipline, independent company, just raised 350 million on a 4.2 billion valuation. And we're ahead of them in progress. Now, you just try raising 350 million round on a no revenue business in Ireland. This doesn't exist. So, but our costs are far lower, right? So around in the United States, the cost 100 quid might cost 20 quid in Ireland, you know, because cost base is much lower. And also there's a really rapidly diminishing return on capital when you're applying it to engineering and R&D, right? Now, capital is essential for scaling, you know, but that's OPEX scaling, right? It's normal, you know, hiring people on the ground, operations or manufacturing, things like that. That's a linear return on capital, right? But at the engineering and risk phase, there isn't a linear return. It's a cliff, right? So you can only have so many engineers working on one problem. And so we don't need a lot of capital. You know, a company like Manna, we've raised 40. We'd probably be a viable business with another, I don't know, 50, 100, 200 million, that kind of area, not billions. But that doesn't exist in Ireland either.
So how do you raise it?
Oh, you just raise internationally. I mean, the money's there, but US money more or less wants to see, particularly such an operationally intensive business like ours, they want to see presence in the USA. They want to see the founder in the coffee shop every Thursday morning kind of thing. They're lazy. I mean, there's unfair to them a little bit, but I understand that they want to see it all the time. They want it to be there.
Familiarity, yeah.
It's irrational, but it's there, right? So we have a big disadvantage by being in Ireland. And also just selling the business. I mean, we're operating in Blanchardstown, Balbriggan, you know, investors don't travel, not to Ireland anyway. I mean, unless they happen to be coming to Europe. Even then, we've giant investors in the UK or USA even that have never seen our operation because it's just too far away. You know, just the way it is. You have to be realistic. So it's a huge disadvantage geographically, our position. But again, I don't want to overstate it. Look, if I was building the business again, I would do it again in Ireland. Like I'm not in Ireland because I have people or family here. I'll be wherever the business needs to be. It's not personal. It's about the business is best served by many facets of being in Dublin and Ireland that serve us really well. And it's only capital where we fall short. But as I said, just look at the policies we have with ISIF, their fund of funds, some direct investing. Enterprise Ireland at the earlier stages, even now, Enterprise Ireland are a massive boost for us. You know, they have people all over the world getting me into the regulator in this country, that country, helping me meet policy people in this country. Like, it's phenomenal. And no other country in the world has that tool set, you know, for companies to use as they see fit. And I've yet to meet someone in Enterprise Ireland, whether here or globally, that doesn't want to really help and is smart enough to actually make a difference for us.
I think that's overlooked a lot.
It isn't. Like, people love to bash stuff, right?
They do, yeah.
And they say, you know, they're bureaucratic and they're not. I'm on the phone with them all the time. They're just like, you'd hire half of them, you know? They're like, it's a phenomenally strong asset that we have. So again, coming back to, would I build Manna here? Yes, I would. Of course I would. I would build Manna here all day long. We need to fix the capital problem.
So what does the next 3 years look like for Manna then?
Next 3 years is, right. Well, so the last 5 years, we've proven unit economics, aircraft economics and longevity. So we can put 20,000 flights on aircraft already. We've proven regulatory. We've proven market fit, proven all the high risk things. So next stage is, I think of us like we've built the Roadster now and we're going to skip the S and go straight to the 3. And so we want to start scaling up manufacturing. We want to deploy. We want to build this year. We want to reach about 1 million customers in Ireland and about the same in Germany. And thereafter, there's a lot of digestion to undergo just to scale up that much. So we need scale manufacturing in place. We need capital for that, obviously. So next year or two, I would say moderate growth where we become a real business with a normal P&L. that you would expect to see. And we start to dilute our central cost, the R&D and all that kind of stuff. So we become a normal throttling up business next year too. And then year three, it's not another next 3 years, it's next 10 years. Cause this isn't a decade business. It's a 2-decade business. So I would like to think that in 5 to 10 years, every single suburb in Europe and the USA will have drone delivery, and most of those will be with Mana logo on it.
Are you building the infrastructure, or are you actually going to build the company to deploy all that?
No, the infrastructure is zero. It's just the aircraft uses the ground to fly off. So there's a charging station. So we put a shipping container in, you store the craft overnight. And even now, we probably won't store the craft overnight. They'll probably just autonomously find their way back to a central base for maintenance and inspection. So what's in the base, like in the car park of your big Camille Thai restaurant or whatever it is, is just a box that has the charging units in it. Because charging is a big deal for this thing. Like it's not straightforward. It's a big part of our tech is charging, discharging, battery management. So that actually lives where the base is. Mm-hmm. And then aircraft will all fly out from a central base somewhere in center Dublin, for example. And every morning they'll fly out to Tala, Dundrum, Blanchardstown, whatever, do their work and come back at night for overnight inspection and stuff like that. So there's no real infrastructure. There's finding bases to put the aircraft to work. And finding partners, you know, like for Blanchardstown, everyone knows we're going live in Blanchardstown. It might be tomorrow. We'll see. Just read all the last minute stuff. And we already have over 1,000 people have downloaded the app. Everyone's ready and dying for us to start delivering. And we have 22 vendors out there, restaurants and different brands. And everyone knows who the brands are. Well, they don't know who the brands are, but they know the brands. So we have everything ready. And that will be by far the world's largest, most complex drone delivery operation. And it will be by far the only profitable drone delivery operation where no other company has profitable unit economics. So we're not just a bunch of propeller heads that are building cool. There's also a lot of sobriety to it. And the unit economics are actually profitable. So.
And it's just bloody cool as well, though. It is bloody cool. And like every time I see one of the videos, I'm like, I was talking to my wife on the way in. I was like, oh, I'm chatting to Bobby today. He's building Mana.
Do you know what's great is how much everyone else shares the excitement that I have.
Oh, it's cool.
Like everyone loves the idea. Like there's very few people that say, no, don't like it. You know, it is just so interesting. And so cool. And wait till you get the product. Like wait till you order your first drone delivery.
I remember seeing the first video of this. I remember watching on Twitter going, because, you know, tech is very granular in terms of, or gradual even, in terms of like just little improvements. Whereas this is one of those like...
It's all. Because you don't get to fly until it's perfect because it's not safe, right? So you're going to see this big ass aircraft arriving at about 80, 90 kilometers an hour. And hovering over your house, just this magical process, especially at night where you see all the aviation lights flashing and our torch shining, a big, you know, circle on the ground. It's like wild. It's so interesting. And I must say that's a personal point of that I really like is how much everyone is invested in it. Like personally, everyone, like the amount of inbound I get from people emailing me or contacting us some way, you know, or asking us to hurry up and bring the product to their neighborhood. Like you don't get that with any product.
No, you don't. You know, and it's one of those things you want to try it. You want it to be here.
Everyone wants to try it. And then on top of that, nobody's disappointed. Our NPS is between 80 and 90, net promoter score. Like it's not even that everyone's dying to get it. It's like it also really, really works and everyone loves it after they get it. It's like broadband. Like, you know, how long were you waiting to get Wi-Fi or broadband to your house? And the moment you got it, your life changed.
I stalked the fiber installers as they were walking up.
Same.
Every day I'd be like, when do you reckon, how far? 2 months?
Right, same.
Okay. Every day walking the dog, watching them put it up. Like just very few bits of technology that you have an emotional feeling for going, I can't wait to get this.
This is the same. I mean, it's got that level of pent-up demand waiting for it. And then the way that translates, that's obviously very personally nice for me, right? I do enjoy that part because everyone wants to talk about it, mostly like it. That also translates to... the investability in the business, because this is something that ultimately ends up in every single suburban home on the planet because everyone wants it. And that means that it's not just the industry we're serving today of 5.5 billion orders. It's we're going to create a market that never existed. Like the biggest thing we deliver now is hot coffee, right? Cappuccinos. Mm. 30% of our volume is people just ordering a coffee. And they don't do it as a one-off. They do it regularly. Yeah. So the point
part
is
of your life.
That's a market that never existed before.
And it's a pull. Right. It's a pull. Usually companies are pushing, pushing, pushing,
it's
pushing. Try this.
It's a pull.
The company, customers are pulling it.
Yep.
Right. I got to get you out here. So we've got to do a quick fire round. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur must read?
Two books. Nike Shoe Dog, just to teach people about the madness and the loneliness and the heartache of founding a business.
Deck Brian recommended that last week. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great book.
I might have recommended that to him or he recommended it to me. I can't remember which. And then the second one is Super Pumped, which is a modern day equivalent. It's Uber, story of Uber.
Yes. It's got
not the movie, the book, right? Mm-hmm. And in different ways, they both tell the same story. One more traditionally, selling and making runners and working with the Japanese and the heartache of, you know, that type of relationship. And then the tech version of Super, both amazing books.
Shoe Dog is unbelievable.
Yeah.
What value, you're a good man for ideas. So tell me this, what valuable business is no one building?
Drone delivery.
You're building that, sure.
Yeah, but not enough people are building it. I mean, someone asked me earlier on, I spoke to an investor earlier on looking for bets in the space. And I said, build something that can compete with Mana. There's lots of room. It's massive business. And we've set the way. It's easy to copy. Well, no, it's not. But what other business? So many. Look, the easiest money is my past world, travel technology. Any fool could make a lot of money in travel technology, building enterprise SaaS. But it's boring and you won't be proud and, you know, you'll die no happier. And that's it. That's all I know. I'm a one trick pony.
I love the honesty. What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
Give it to Deborah, the charity I support.
Okay. I see you do a lot of work for them, actually. Incredible.
Yeah. What's and everyone should donate to Deborah that's listening to this or find out who Deborah is. Deborah Ireland.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
What's something in your daily routine you wish had started sooner?
Oh, Jesus. In my daily routine, I wish I started sooner. Drinking coffee. Yeah. There is nothing in my daily routine.
Just craft.
Yes, work. Yeah. I mean, I have four kids. That's busy. Well, I'm a better father now, I think, than I was 20 years ago. But no, there's nothing. My life hasn't changed since I'm, you know, 18 years old.
I'll give you 1 million euro. You can invest in one person or company. Who would you invest in?
Microsoft. Sorry, if you just want a return on your money, Microsoft.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. If you just start another company in the morning, what would it be?
Drone delivery. Another company, what would it be? I have loads of things that I'm interested in from the tech learning point of view, right? So yeah. I'd love to build software systems, particularly around data recognition and, you know, like a lot of the kind of off-the-shelf stuff and orchestrating those tools, like so computer vision, sensors, all those things. But I think where I'd really like to apply and, you know, if I was building a big business, it would be in defense. Maybe military defense and maybe drones or something. Like, look at Anduril, right?
It's an incredible story. Yeah. I've heard him speak on podcasts.
Incredible,
what a character.
Right? And it's only the start of it now. Just look at the defense budgets being spent. And you know, obviously you have to think long and hard about, you know, working for defense and
military stuff,
of course. But there's plenty of applications in there that are good for the world that just the customer happens to be armies. And the technology gap and the lag in defense is just incredible. They're 20, 30 years behind and it's time for them to catch up. And I think technology can help make the world much more peaceful. And so, you know, there's a good mission to be had there with your life to build in that space. And I think there's a shit ton of money as well to be made.
That helps. What's the one thing you believe other people strongly disagree with?
That I believe, drone delivery. Still, like even 5 years later, even though we're flying, people still don't believe it's possible and they don't believe it's a real business. And they don't know why, by the way. And if you come back in 2 years' time, I'd say that'll be gone. But 5 years later, here we are. And most people I speak to don't believe it. Don't believe it's coming. Or just they don't get it. Like, look at my stuff on LinkedIn. There's so many experts on LinkedIn, geniuses pointing out why it'll never work, why the economics don't work. And yet here we are with profitable economics, with sensationally successful customer response. So that's the one. And it's all the experts on LinkedIn trying to make a name for themselves, you know, consulting.
I'm going to show Bobby.
And they're falling every time. It's like machine gun fire every time I see one or I post something, they row in with their pitch. See, the thing is, I have data on my side that shows that it works. And up to now, I have had just opinion and viewpoints on my side, but now I have proof. So that's the one up to now. And I've been, even me, that's a, you know, glass half full, glass half empty person, I never expected the level of cynicism or disbelief about what we've been building. Because to me, it's always been obvious that it will work. But I'm, a, like I said, glass half full, glass half empty. I'm moderate in terms of, you know, of that. But I was, I'm still surprised still that there's smart people that don't see it yet. And that's good news because it means that no one else is really building. There's almost, there is no competition in the world yet for us. So that's a good place to be.
What's one thing you spend money on in your personal life that brings you a lot of happiness?
Chess.com.
Chess.com.
Yeah. So if I'm not on Twitter and if I'm not working or on Slack or whatever, I'm on chess.com. YouTube, none of that.
There you go.
Nothing. Chess.com.
Insight into Bobby's brain. What's your final piece of advice for every entrepreneur listening?
Well, if you're already an entrepreneur, you don't need my advice. My advice to, if you're not or you're thinking about it, is do. I don't like the word entrepreneur, by the way. It's just such a shit word,
rebrand.
Right?
What are we going to rebrand to?
Just
has
build.
To rhyme. Like,
just do it as early as you can. So the advice is, look, just do it. Build something. There's no such thing as failure. You will enjoy it immensely and you will be a better person for trying to do it. But you can mitigate your chances of failure by building a network of people to learn from, people to get advice from, most of which, by the way, they annoy you. They're asking for too much advice. And if you're asking for too much advice, maybe it's not for you in the first place. But for me, probably the biggest reason I've got any type of success is the people that have come along with me to build with me, right? I've been very good at building teams of great people. And that takes decades. Like, it takes so long to build a team. You're taking, like in Elan, you know, four of the people that worked in Elan continue to work for me in my next company out of 120. Oh. So the hit rate isn't great, right? So,
but they come with you all the same.
You need to be always looking for people, great people to either start a business with or to come work for you or whatever. But so my advice to anyone, entrepreneur or not, is always be networking. Maybe the word networking is wrong, but building that list of people that have skills, that have knowledge, whatever, building your world of people that you can talk to and maybe come work for you, build something together. That is the biggest thing for me in when I built Mana, I had the team ready. When I built Mailey, founded Mailey with Mike, had the team ready. 30 people, hired them straight away. Mana, same. The entire software team, Alan Hicks builds all the software and all the team I have, I knew them already. So if you find yourself in need of someone with a particular skill set at a particular point in time and then you start to go look for them, you've already failed.
Yeah.
I have a note with everyone I've ever met with their skill set. And when I need someone that knows about electric motors, they're in the list already. And so that's a huge tool of the trade, I think.
That's phenomenal. Build your database. Bobby, where can people learn more about Mana and yourself?
Twitter.
Follow Bobby on Twitter for the crack.
Please follow me on Twitter. No, mana.aero, the website. But like, there's a lot of noise about us. But, you know, Twitter and LinkedIn is probably where we push out the most real-time stuff.
Definitely. People will find you. Bobby, that was an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.